Since 1937, Ducks Unlimited has been the leader in waterfowl conservation, with over 16 million acres of habitat conserved. DU supporters and volunteers have led the charge to fill the skies with waterfowl, today, tomorrow, and forever. You too can play a role in leaving a legacy for the future of waterfowl hunting. To find an event near you or to join our volunteer team, go to www.ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
Welcome to the Standard Sportsman Podcast. The show features trending topics, touching all aspects of duck and goose hunting in an effort to motivate others to leave the resource better than they found it. Hosts Cason Short and Brent Birch are lifelong Arkansas hunter conservationists, delivering thought-provoking discussions with engaging guests before, during, and after duck season. Thanks for spending time with us today. Now let's jump into today's show with the guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Standard Sportsman. I'm Cason Short, joined as always with Brent Birch. Brent, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm glad to be talking ducks. I've been in a meeting for 2 hours. Talking ducks is a lot better way to spend an afternoon.
Yeah. Well, we got something to talk about today, duck specific. We thought we were going to talk a lot of ducks last week, but we ended up hearing surprisingly more dog conversation than duck conversation. And I point that out just to say that while ducks get a lot of publicity in the state of Arkansas, it seems as though the residents sometimes have bigger concerns than maybe just ducks. Kind of interesting meeting if you want to dive into that for a minute.
Yeah, I definitely can. And what he's referring to is we attended they kind of call it the business meeting, but it's the Wednesday of the 2-day Arkansas Game and Fish Commissioner meeting. You know, they meet on Wednesday. Most people are only familiar with the Thursday meeting because that's the one that's streamed on YouTube and you can actually watch it and all that. Now they, you know, being a public entity, they have to record the Wednesday meeting, but it's not streamed. So, but that's where their committees meet. In public, anybody can attend that kind of thing. But we were there to share, you know, our input from our advisory councils and what we were hearing on the street, and there were some other speakers. But yeah, the dog, you know, there's some regulations out there that are required to put trackers on dogs, and it's not all necessarily hunting wise. It was even on these field trials that they run with these beagles and all these other dogs, you know, deer tracking dogs, all that. And there's been some hell raised by landowners that all these dogs are showing up on their porch that are out running these trials and running these hunts. So that had a large turnout for this meeting, even though they were kicking through every duck regulation that's on the table. There were way more people in the room talking about dogs.
Yeah, there was, I think, five or six of us here with our guests that were there to talk ducks, and the other, I don't know, 65, 70 were there for dogs.
Yeah. I knew something was up when we pulled in the Game and Fish parking lot and all the trucks with the dog boxes in the back.
Yeah, definitely caught my attention. But, you know, kudos to them for showing up and voicing their opinion about something they care about. I feel like a lot of times duck hunters may be kind of vocal on social media or in their local watering hole, but when it comes to make decisions, they don't really show up.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Everybody's an expert on Facebook groups and blowing up comments on Instagram and everything else. But, you know, to actually show up in the room and share your passion and why you agree or disagree with what the commission's kicking around, you know, those guys deserve some credit, both sides of the fence on that one.
And that's why we're here today. We've got a guest here that showed up, that spoke and had a very compelling argument and won a lot of hearts and minds on the commission. So why don't you introduce our guest and give a little background, and then we'll get into his message and what he had to say.
The Standard Sportsman Podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors. Waterfowl hunters deserve to have a set of waders that can excel year in and year out throughout the duration of the season. So Sitka Gear set out to build the best pair of waders ever. Constructed from Gore-Tex Pro Laminate, the face fabric offers added durability and is breathable in active working conditions while completely sealing out the elements. Importantly, they proudly stand behind all of their Delta Zip Waiter features with their 100% serviceable guarantee. And I'm speaking from experience as I have sent my original pair of Sitka Waiters from the 2018 season back twice without a hiccup. Engineered to outwork, outlast, and outhunt everything else in the market, the Delta Zip Waiter from Sitka Gear is the gold standard for reliability. The Chatham Jacket from Tom Beckby features a durable, weatherproof 8-ounce wax shelter cloth shell that develops a great-looking patina with use. I've actually worn this jacket the last couple of seasons and appreciate the shorter cut to it, so it fits great inside my waders. It's also a really good weight for most Arkansas days afield. So if you'd like to mix a little vintage look with your technical gear waders, this is the jacket. You can find the jacket online at tombeckby.com. You can also find it in their brick-and-mortar locations in Wilson, Arkansas, Birmingham, Alabama, and the new store in Oxford, Mississippi.
Yeah, so we've got a friend of mine on the show. We're actually neighbors. Our duck hunting properties are very close to each other, and I'm very thankful I'm nearby, David, because he's got a heck of a property and does an amazing job managing for waterfowl. And so we'll talk a little bit about that and some of that, and then we'll get into what he really lobbied for with the commission last week that ended up getting a lot of support. But we've got on the show today David Snowden. So, David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and have enjoyed listening to you guys' podcast.
Yeah. Well, you know, we talk ducks a lot, and this is the same way Case and I got started with this podcast. We talk about it so much. And we decided, well, why don't we, these discussions we have, why don't we start recording them? And maybe some other people like what we have to say or what we're talking about and all that. So, you know, David and I share a lot of conversations, not with just what we were seeing in our little part of the world, but on a much bigger scale, north of the border, south of the border, all that. So it's, you know, he's a guy that's very, very passionate about waterfowl and managing habitat and has a long history, but, and done some cool things, you know, at a national level. And I don't want to steal his thunder because I'm going to ask him maybe to share a little background for those that don't know you and your kind of your track record and not only duck hunting, but the conservation efforts related to ducks. So why don't you tell, you know, share a little bit about you and then we'll kind of jump into, you know, where you hunt and some of the things you're doing there that are fantastic for waterfowl.
Okay, well, thank you again for having me. And I, just to be totally transparent, sometimes you guys are cutting in and out. So if I don't respond to something, that may be why. But yeah, I'm a passionate duck hunter. Grew up in Arkansas. Have hunted ducks, you know, since before I can really remember. I can't tell you my first duck hunt. It's been in our family for a long time. I hunt, you know, our club is called Kingdom Come. Brent, certainly you know where it is. We're neighbors just across the bayou from each other. Yeah, you know, and I'm just passionate about it. I'm like anybody else. I'm not an expert. Have just spent my lifetime out in the field observing and had an interest in waterfowl. At an early age, I got involved really peripherally in conservation. My parents used to run the Ducks Unlimited sponsor dinner back in the early 70s when DU was really just getting going. And I used to go to those as a kid with them and really enjoyed the dinner, not so much because of the purpose behind it. They were just fun. As I got older, I got involved with the sponsor dinner, actually chaired it for several years. Worked with Steve Smith, who used to run the Game and Fish Foundation. And we worked closely together on that. And, you know, then I realized what the mission was and really wanted to raise as much money as we could for DU at the time. Later in my life, and I would say this was in the mid-90s, had a couple of guys come hunt. And this is a story in itself that I won't walk us through. But basically, the executive director of Delta Waterfowl and one of its board members came and hunted with us. My first time really to get to know Delta Waterfowl, what it was about, and enjoyed being with them so much that that started to cultivate a relationship with that organization. I was invited to go up there on the prairies during the, you know, the breeding season, and to see, you know, what was going on with my own eyes and to learn more about it. Ultimately, I was invited to join their board. And I guess before that, I held the first Delta Waterfowl event in Arkansas, and just invited people I knew. I wanted them to come learn more about Delta Waterfowl. At that point, it was more of a research organization. They had trained a good number of the scientists that were working in the waterfowl world at that point. So it wasn't a membership-driven organization like it is today. In fact, there were very few members, maybe, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 at that time. And it was mainly just hardcore guys that appreciated the science that were willing to contribute to fund the science. And then, you know, as things evolved for them, it became more of a membership-driven organization with the same mission. After my stint on Delta Waterfowl, I kind of took a step back from the conservation organizations and really tried to focus on our property. You know, I thought I need to make this as good as I can possibly make it. And there was, a lot to do over the years. And so I just didn't want to be pulled away sitting through meetings and basically doing that kind of work on a national scale. So I took a step back from that. I have been on the Nature Conservancy Board for over 20 years. And for those that aren't familiar with the Nature Conservancy, they've done as much for ducks in Arkansas as any conservation organization. Since I've been on the board, we've reforested over 200,000 acres of hardwood bottomlands in the White and Cache River bottoms. And we have an objective within the next 10 years to reforest another 200,000 acres. So a lot of this is private land. Some of it's public, but the bottom line is a lot of it is wintering waterfowl habitat. And so that is a big deal. It's going to be a big deal for waterfowl in Arkansas. And, the Nature Conservancy is involved with conservation all over the state. I've had my hands in a lot of different things, different parts of the state, and supported them and their efforts because I truly am one of those that wants to preserve the best that Arkansas has to offer. So conservation's just been in my blood. We all have, you know, mentors and influencers, and this will play a part in what we're going to talk about later. But my father is truly a lover of nature, a hunter, and a conservationist. And he has had a major influence on me. And if you love something, you need to give back to it, both, you know, with your time and effort, your energy, but also with your money, you know, and that doesn't mean it always has to be a lot, but you should support what interests you. You know, every cause has a champion. And if this truly is what you love, then you ought to focus on that and try to make a difference in that world. And so it happens to be that is my interest. I like being involved at all different levels. I think my days of being on boards at a national level are behind me. I would rather just be a single voice out here that, you know, does kind of what y'all do, talk to people, you know, having thought through it and just share my opinion and hopefully do everything with a species first type of slant to it. So anyway, that's kind of my background in conservation.
Well, it's pretty extensive, and you know, that's kind of the things you, a lot of people don't have any idea of some of those things that go on in support of, you know, the ducks. And so, I mean, a lot of should be commended for that. And I know something that I participated in, and Casey and I would both agree, and both came from the same thing as far as mentorship and the conservation world. It came from our fathers and grandfathers, and it's just how we do it. You know, really a lot of thought about the resource, not just killing them. You know, it's kind of a different mindset, but can definitely appreciate that. But something we participated in the last few years is an effort that you've got going on here in the Little Rock area that's pretty awesome, and definitely worth sharing with the audience, because maybe it'll motivate someone that listens to the show that is somewhere else, or even it's a different circle of friends, maybe somebody else in Little Rock, but it's a different circle of friends to do something similar. So maybe share, you know, what you've been doing the last handful of years regarding, you know, raising some money for Delta amongst a group and what the intentions are of that effort.
Yeah, be glad to. So I guess I'll have to think about this. 6 or 7 years ago, I started a group called the 1% Club. And the 1% Club basically contributes money to Delta Waterfowl each year to support their annual trapping effort on the breeding grounds. And let me give you a little history on that and how I came up with that name. When I was on the board in the 90s, I met a guy from North Dakota who remains one of my closest friends today. And I say he's the father of the predator program for Delta. He was the one that came into the board meeting with an idea of trapping and thought that might be a way to give some relief to nesting hens, you know, on the prairies during the season. The reason he came is that there was a waterfowl production area not far from his home in North Dakota that was about 4,000 acres. It had been permanently drained sometime before that, no longer held water, no longer produced ducks. And I'll just say, to leave names out of it, conservation organizations, Fish and Wildlife, and others put in money to restore that wetland. And like I say, about 4,000 acres. It cost about $500,000 to restore it. They had to rebuild the water control structures and do a lot of work, but there was about $400,000 spent on it. For the first 3 years after it was restored, and ducks were fairly plentiful during that time, and they were there. I mean, they were on the wetland. There was zero brood survival. And they were monitoring it closely, and no ducks were making it. Most of the eggs were getting eaten before they ever hatched, but then they also had some mortality after the hatch. And so my friend, who was a member of a wildlife club in the area at that point, he was a trapper. He knew the benefits of trapping. And he suggested that the area be trapped going into the next year and see what the results would be. So they did that. They raised $4,000 or $5,000 to hire a trapper and go in there and trap just during the breeding season. Well, that spring, they counted 360 broods on the 4,000 acres. So for $4,000 or $5,000, they went from zero nest success to 360 broods. So if you think of the math there, you know, if you say they spent $400 to restore it and spent $4 just to make it easy numbers to trap, that's 1%. And so he came to the, and that's just me, I'm jumping ahead of myself. That's how I got the name of the club. But he brought the idea to Delta's board. And Frank Rohr was the executive, not executive director at the time, but he was certainly a chief scientist. And he'll admit this. I wouldn't tell this story if he wouldn't readily admit it. He thought it would never work. And he really didn't think it would work on scale, but he was not in favor of it. And my friend, Rob Volrath in North Dakota, can be pretty persistent. And so Rob won out, Delta goes out, and they basically run a scientific study on it. Everything they did was science. So they not only had to do it once, they had to do it repetitively before they would come out and make a statement about it. And so they did a small area the first year, and they had a control block right next to it with the same type of habitat. And the initial results were eye-opening, to say the least. And so they had to do it again the following year. And they were getting pretty excited about what they saw in the initial year. And they continued to expand the scale of the work. And I got involved in that they finally said, okay, we need to do this on a township-wide basis. A township isn't something that in the South we're as familiar with, but basically it's 36 square miles. And so they were going to trap 36 square miles, and they were going to have a control block that was not going to be trapped right in the area, same type of habitat, same number of ducks, that would not be trapped, and they would do a comparison. And I was one of the initial funders to do that project. I had bought into it. I was seeing the numbers. They were getting, you know, at a minimum three times the nest success, but consistently more like four times nest success on the trapped units. And so they did it on this big control, on this township-wide block, and the results were the same. So now they knew they had something. Again, they're scientists. And so they continued to try to replicate this over and over and over. They kept coming up with the same good results. And so that was kind of the advent of the Predator program for Delta. And I always thought the big win, and we all did, the big win would be not just if Delta was out there doing it, but if everybody else that had a hand in waterfowl production would do it. So that's conservation organizations, Fish and Wildlife Service, state game agencies through their waterfowl production areas, et cetera. Get everybody on board. Well, that was a lot harder to do than expected, maybe for me. I think others didn't expect it to be easy, but I thought the results speak for themselves. Why would anybody who cares about the betterment of ducks not embrace this? But they did for various reasons. So Delta Waterfowl has now been trapping for 30 years, and they've been closely monitoring the nest success. So with that, I had an idea 7 or so years ago to start a group of dedicated waterfowl enthusiasts to support the effort. And I put together a group called the 1% Club. And the name came from the story I told initially. And our charge is to raise $50,000 a year to support trapping on a township. So we basically just taken on a township and said that we'll do our part to do that on that scale. It was interesting because it took me a day and a half to get 50 people. And I think out of 53 phone calls that I made, 50 of them said, I'm on board. So that was kind of neat when it came together so quickly. And so that's what we do for the last 7 years. We've been raising about $50,000 a year. Sometimes it's more and sometimes it's a little less. We do have a little bit of turnover, but you're talking roughly anywhere from 40 to 55 guys that contribute to that. A question that I ask of Delta Waterfowl really simplifies this, and that is, is this group of guys replacing the ducks that we take? And I'm not talking about our duck clubs as a whole, just each of us individually. If you just do the math on approximately how many ducks we all shoot individually in a year, by contributing $1,000 to this program, are we a net contributor or a net taker? And the answer came back, no question, you're a net contributor. You know, if you're in, I kind of used 100 ducks a year on average. Some hunt more than others. So as a group, if you just set 100 ducks a year, yeah, you're covering that. I thought that was pretty neat. We're doing it for the greater good, but if nothing else, it makes all of us feel better that we're raising more ducks than we're harvesting in a season. And that resonates and is a pretty simple sell with this group. So that's the effort that I've been doing more recently.
For over 30 years, Lyle Real Estate has been connecting land investors and outdoorsmen with sellers. Whether looking to invest in an income-producing farm or recreational land, the Lyle Real Estate team has the connections and the expertise to help. They work with tracts of all sizes and specialize in agricultural, timberland, and recreational properties. New listings are hitting the market almost weekly, so head on over to their website to learn more. www.lylerealestate.com.
Yeti. From the legendary hard coolers to the new barware series, Yeti has you covered. Or check out one of my favorite new products from them, the Loadout Series Go Box. Yeti, built for the wild.
So, I mean, saying what you've said here and talking about the nesting ground and hen mortality, it kind of leads way to where we picked up last week with you speaking at the commission meeting. So tell our audience a little bit, or if you want to, kind of go back through what you said at the meeting and your, I don't want to call it an argument because it was very cordial. It was not an argument, but your stance on hen harvest and why you think it should be reduced to one in the overall limit.
Okay. So yeah, I made a case to the Game and Fish Commission that I think it would be wise at this time to reduce the hen mallard limit to one hen. And to kind of walk you back through, I guess, my organized thoughts going into that meeting, I look at where the mallard population is today, and you guys have done a great job of making everybody aware of the decline that's taken place. But the mallard population from 2017 to 2022, based on the Fish and Wildlife's estimates, has dropped from over 10 million to just over 6. So that's a 42% decline in the last 5 years. We'll see what happens this year, but we all know the state of the prairies. It's not looking good, and I fully expect that 6 million will be an even lower number. So we may approach a 50% decline in 6 years. There has been forever a lot of arguing or differences in thinking of harvest impact on the overall mortality of ducks. You know, I'm a believer that there's always some impact. You know, the compensatory theory says, well, the excess ducks would die anyway. And the additive theory says every duck we kill is only dead because we shot it with a shotgun. And I don't think either one of them, you know, holds true all the time. You know, the truth is probably in my mind in the middle. But what I think is, when the mallard population begins to slide like it's been sliding, I think we need to pay attention and we need to give the ducks every chance we can. And there's a lot of people that would argue, well, there's not enough habitat for them. I mean, that's the reason they're down to begin with.
So, you know, people say, a lot of people say you can't stockpile ducks. And I disagree with that statement. I know the truth is somewhere in the middle. And if the hen mortality, well, if a mallard lives on average to be 5 years, and that's what most of the data I can pull up says, and let's just say, even if it's 2 years, and we all probably would suspect that a hen's life expectancy is lower than a drake's. So even if 2 years, there's some carryover there. And I would argue that you can stockpile ducks to a degree. And, you know, a hen that doesn't nest. So if a hen returns to the prairie and doesn't make an attempt to nest, her chances of survivability have to be higher because she's not sitting on a nest. You know, the ones on the nest are the most vulnerable. And we all know that the majority of hens get killed during that time. You know, a lot of what I have learned is, you know, that number may be as high as 30-35% of hens die during the nesting season. But I still say you can stockpile ducks to a degree. And I just think that it's prudent when ducks are down like they are now and going lower that we protect the hens as best we can. A lot of those hens, I'll say excess hens, if you want to divide or section off the hens that we would save from not shooting them during the season, they will attempt to nest. There's enough habitat up there for them to make an attempt. Not all the habitat's going to be great, but there's still good habitat that's available. And so I think if nothing else, we just need to lay off the hens as much as possible and make sure there are plenty in the flock so that when Mother Nature does turn and give us a break with more moisture on the prairies, that we have more hens to take advantage of. So this isn't saying that it will turn it around in and of itself, but what I hope it will do is to shallow that trough, the decline. We'll have more hens available when the time is better, and we will see a rebound from the bottom more quickly with that. You know, if you think about it, we put hundreds of millions of dollars into ducks, really on an annual basis. There's a lot of time and effort that we spend talking about ducks. There's a lot of people contributing money to ducks, and there's a lot of public funding through congressional appropriation to ducks. So we have hundreds of millions of dollars. Most of that goes into habitat work. And I'm the first one to say we need it. We need to conserve all the habitat we can because despite our efforts, it's shrinking. And that's a problem. You know, we've got urban sprawl. We have, you know, drainage going on in ag lands. You know, there's a lot of reasons why habitat is disappearing. And so, I look at the amount of money, time, and effort that's going into conserved ducks, yet the Fish and Wildlife still allows us to kill two hens. I mean, they are our baby producers. It just makes no sense to me. We can't shoot hen turkeys. We can't shoot hen pheasant. You know, there's other species of birds that we can't shoot. And it's a rhetorical question, but I say, why not? Why can't we? Well, we know the answer. And yet we allow half a mallard harvest to be hens. And so as somebody that participates in this conservation, that gives money to its betterment, I start scratching my head and thinking through, why are we allowed to kill two hens? I understand killing one. We make mistakes. I make mistakes. I try not to kill them. I try hard not to kill a hen, but I do make a mistake occasionally. And it's a flying bird. Conditions can be dark. You know, there's lots of reasons why you can shoot a hen even when you're not trying to. But most of the time, if you put the effort in, you can be selective and take drakes. And, you know, some people argue, well, you know, early morning, you can't really see what you're shooting, et cetera. Well, you can. Again, you're supposed to by law. Yeah. And you're selective with your shots. I mean, or you pass on the shot. I mean, it takes a little bit of discipline. And, you know, one of the things I mentioned when I spoke the other day is, so does the 3-point rule on white-tailed deer. And look how popular that is now. You know, when it first came out, people were against it. It took more discipline on the hunter to look at that deer, to size him up and decide, does he have 3 points or does he not? I mean, I can't just make a snapshot because I see antlers. Well, the same goes with ducks. And, you know, we've had to identify species and sex forever as duck hunters. We had the point system back in the 80s. I think a hen mallard got up to 100 points, or not 100, to 90 points. Mm-hmm. We had to know what a hen looked like. Mm-hmm. No matter when she came in. So I don't really see that holds a lot of water. I feel like people, you know, some people that are in favor of it are just more concerned with killing a limit, and a hen helps them get there more quickly and easier than having to be just a little more selective. But I think based on where we are today with the mallard population, I just believe we need to be conservative at the moment. If the mallards jump back up to 10 million ducks, then, you know, whatever the Game and Fish decides to do with the hens, I'm not going to be a very vocal case on that. But when the mallards are down, then I think, you know, at least I'm in favor of some conservatism, and let's take care of the species first. The rest of it will follow.
You mentioned the identification argument, and that was a rebuttal that we all kind of heard last week in that room. And it really stood out to me, you know, as a guide and outfitter, it is our job to identify birds. As hunters, it's all of our jobs, you know. So that was, I didn't think that was a good argument on why not to, you know, allow two hens, or excuse me, why not to restrict it to one? But you mentioned something a little further back. You mentioned stockpiling ducks, and that's the argument that we hear all the time about harvest regulations, and that harvest regulations don't produce ducks, right? And you can't stockpile. It's all habitat. And that's true. We live and die by habitat. There's no question. I had this discussion with someone on social media just last week, and I brought up the point that our regulations are now set 2 years in advance. We're blocking off these liberal framework long before we know what the breeding population and the mapon counts are going to look like. And my rebuttal, my argument to this person was, hey, if we send back twice as many hens due to harvesting one less, or even if it's 20% more, 10% more, you pick it, doesn't matter. If we send back more hens than we would have, and suddenly we find ourselves on an uptick in habitat, now we're sending back nesters that have habitat to do it. And that's my whole point. And I agree 100% with what you're saying. With a population this low, it's theorized, or maybe it wasn't a theory, a well-regarded biologist in Canada released a slide at the flyway meetings that said there could be as few as 1 million hens in the Mississippi flyway. And you look at harvest rates on these birds, and we're knocking out a pretty good chunk of those every year. So those are pretty scary, pretty low numbers. I don't think it's beyond comprehension to think, hey, maybe we should let some of these get a pass. I mean, that's how low the numbers are. And no, it's not going to be the fix. We're not going to skyrocket to 10 million birds next year. But I think it's just kind of the common sense reform that when this does start to swing the other way, we're going to send a few more back and get a head start on rebounding that population.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, I mean, you guys have heard it from some of your other guests on your show, and I know you have heard it from hunters just in conversation. We all love waterfowl. We all marvel at waterfowl, and we love our season. And, I should have said this in the beginning. I have said what I've said because nobody wants to preserve a 60-day season more than I do. I spend all year thinking about ducks, working for ducks, and just – basically it's just on our minds, you know, all year long. And I want as many days in the field every winter as I can get. And so there are a lot of variables that affect ducks, and there's a lot going on that affect ducks, and most of it's not good. And like I say, this is one variable that hunters can control. And I think there's a lot of hunters out there that want to do something and feel empowered to be able to make a difference. It's not going by itself to be the difference, but it is a small part in something we can do to help with the current situation the way it is. You know, a lot of little pieces add up to a big piece. And again, most of the ducks are getting killed by predators on the pothole region, you know, while they're nesting. I know that. This effort, if we go to one hen, is not going to move the needle significantly. But where it would move the needle more significantly is if we can set an example and get other states to follow our lead. Now, I've already had one email from another state in our flyway wanting more information, wanting to know, you know, kind of what our thoughts are, had heard that the Game and Fish was going to do this. And that's, I think if you had a collaboration among the states and did this, then I think it is a meaningful percentage, but somebody has to take the lead. And I'm glad last week that our commissioners, you know, have done that for now. I don't count my chickens till the eggs are hatched. I guess it'll be approved in the May meeting. And hopefully they'll stand by, you know, their unanimous vote in favor of this. But it will make a difference. And it's the ducks that we send back, you know, there's some exponent to their production. You know, the ones that nest and pull off, you know, a clutch of eggs, you know, some of those ducks, you know, it stands to reason that some of those ducks will survive and some of their, you know, the next generation will survive. So, you know, there ought to be some pyramiding effect to this. Again, I know that us alone, it's not a big number, but it's a meaningful number. And I'll say this to back that up, and you kind of touched on case and what might the number be. Delta waterfowl, you know, I think pretty much people know, you know, they're undergoing a million duck campaign initiative where they're going to produce a million ducks year after year after year in perpetuity. They're raising the money to endow. And they'll use the earnings off of that to pay for this effort. They're going to do it through trapping, which will produce about 3/4 of the ducks. The other quarter will be through erecting just over 100,000 new hen houses. And when I was asking them a lot of questions about this, I asked about the hen houses, which are very successful. If a mallard nests in them, she has an 80% nest success. That compares to 4 or 5% on the ground untrapped, just in wild grasslands. So when you think about that, hen houses are very effective, when a mallard nests in them. But they expect to produce 250,000 or a quarter of a million ducks out of the hen houses. Well, half of those will be hens out of all their effort. But 1-to-1 ratio of the hatch rate. And so half will be hens. So that's, 125,000 hens that would be produced from hen houses. By Fish and Wildlife Service estimates, Arkansas killed 389,000 mallards in 2022. Now, I know the ratio isn't 1-to-1. We didn't kill one hen for every drake. There's not as many hens in the flock. Our eyes clearly show us that. There are more drakes. But, pick a number there. I just made an example and said, well, the Fish and Wildlife allows two hens in the limit. So if they do, you could say as many as 195,000 could be hens. Legally, they could be hens. Now, in practice, I'll stipulate that it's not that high. In fact, we heard, in the meeting that right now maybe a quarter of the ducks that we kill are hens, hen mallards. Okay, well, just round 389 to 400, just to make it easy numbers. We're killing nearly 100,000 hens down here. And so if we save half of those, that's 50,000 hens that we send back. Well, Delta Waterfowl is going to raise 125,000 hens and spending a pretty fair amount of money to do it. And so I'm saying with the stroke of a pen, if we change the limit, we can add another 50 to their 125, just as a small example. So is that a meaningful number? To me, it is, especially when you think they're going to raise 125 through their hen house program. I think that's a meaningful add-on to what they're doing. And if other states would follow our lead, then the numbers could be even more meaningful. So the numbers are probably somewhere in between. It's probably greater than 50. It's certainly less than 195,000 if the Fish and Wildlife Service estimates are right. But I think it's a meaningful number of ducks.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. And you're right. It's a multiplier. I mean, there is a true multiplier in this. And it kind of gets back, what they're seeing. I believe traditionally, we talked a lot about ratios here in this little last little segment, but I believe that the traditional number they would like to see is like 1.5 hen to every drake, or 1.5 drake to every hen, something like that. This is what it is. But right now, it's 4 drakes to every hen, and some waterfowl scientists believe it's as high as 5-to-1. So, I mean, and that backs up, we've talked about on the show several times, that backs up what a lot of us are seeing, with our eyes when we're afield. Man, we're seeing a whole lot more drakes than we are hens. And so you start kind of connecting those dots a little bit. So the ratios, that's where the million came from in that slide that was in the Mississippi Flyway Council meeting. If we've got 6 million mallards and you're talking this 5-to-1 ratio, well, 5 million of them are drakes and 1 million of them are hens. And that's kind of scary to think about. But, what also factors into all that, and we've talked about this numerous times on the show too, and something I introduced, or at least I think I introduced it to the commission on a letter I sent them regarding Mickey Heitmeyer's super hen theory, which is another multiplier, so to speak, because for those that aren't familiar, the super hen theory that he has is, it's not what's in the pile, it's who's in the pile. So group of ducks come in, 4 or 5 guys are in the hole, shoot, you drop 3 or 4 drakes. You don't know whether the drakes, drop drakes, and then you drop a couple hens. You don't know those hens that you shot, whether she's a poor producer or is she a super hen that lays a clutch of eggs of, 12 eggs, or maybe she breeds twice in a spring. So we don't know that. So we don't know what we're culling out of the herd, by what we're shooting at. So by reducing that hem limit, we also maybe reduce, the who knows the answer, but are we shooting super hens? Are we shooting bad breeders out? And we just don't know that. So, maybe these selective shots will lead to more super hens returning and producing those big clutches of eggs that survive and generationally survive and generationally also know Arkansas. They have been here. Their genealogy has trained them. Arkansas is where you go. It's not stopping short in Missouri. It's not stopping in the Dakotas. It's going on and traveling south. And to keep that lineage going, we've got to have the hens driving that, because we all know boys chase girls. It's just kind of that logic, and that's what we're dealing with here. So, I think it was well received. I know it's well received in the hunting community. I've talked to a ton of people that about time, that long overdue. Makes total sense, all that, because I mean, we know what we see out in the field, and I've gotten I did hear from one guy that had some pushback, and it kind of came from the angle that, who are you to decide whether shooting two hens is good for me the handful of times a season I go? You're taking away opportunity from me, but that gets back to the kind of the hunter first mentality and not the resource first. And if you put the resource first, odds are the hunting's going to be better, as we've all experienced with our efforts. So I thought that was pretty interesting to note. And one more little point I'll make before we continue on, I've got a buddy, Jason Smith. He's also a listener of the podcast, but he probably tracks farming efforts in Canada more than anybody in the southern part of the United States. It's crazy what he keeps up with. And he's a rice farmer in South Arkansas. But he sends me stuff all the time. And he's got some concern that maybe we aren't looking in the right places too. On top of the predators, the farming practices north of the border and some of the equipment that they're dragging through, it may be having an impact on those nesting hens on the ground too, and those ducklings. And he raises some valid points, and maybe we're not looking in all the, looking in all the right places, on top. We know the predator impact, and we know, and the hen houses will help with this farming practice too, because it gets the hens off the ground. It's very visible where they're nesting, where it's almost impossible to see a nest in those prairie grasses. And these machines are rolling over them. Nothing like it was even 10 years ago and beyond. So, pretty interesting points he raises there too, that makes you think, man, there's so many things working against the mallard hen. Why don't we back off them a little bit? So it makes total sense. And what those numbers turn out to be, we don't know, but I'd rather be putting more hens back up there instead of digging a bigger hole. So when it does get right on the prairie pothole region, we're cranking out a bunch of ducks.
Right. And I've yet to meet the guy that said we have too many ducks.
Right.
So again, a lot of this to me is just common sense. Ducks are down. They need a break. What have we done on all types of species, when we were concerned about them? We've exercised some conservatism. And, I just think we're at a point now that it's beginning to affect all of us. You're hearing a lot of complaints out of hunters saying duck season's just no good. And so why not do something proactive now to help the rebound, it's slightly until Mother Nature turns, and then, it ought to have more of a profound effect when it does. And I just want to touch on something else, Brent, and this is not necessarily quite on topic, but what you were talking about with the ag practices. And this gets back to we're losing habitat. A real downside to these droughts on the prairie is that it does allow the agricultural community to get in there and permanently drain their wetlands. I go up there every year. I'm not always up there during the breeding season, but I'm up there every year. And a couple of winters ago, I was up there, and the ground was frozen. And in a quarter of a mile stretch, you know, from my buddy's hunting lodge, there were three sets of machines out in fields laying drain tile, permanently draining wetlands that'll never come back. So that is gone. And again, I don't blame the farmer. I know what they're dealing with trying to farm around these potholes. I have wet ground down at Stuttgart that I cuss all the time when I'm trying to do work down there. And so I get, you know, where they are. I mean, when it costs them, oh, my numbers aren't going to be current, but it used to cost them about $500 an acre to lay drain tile. And that, let's just say it's $1,000 a day with inflation, as opposed to they could go buy an equal amount of land next door to them if it was available for $5,000 an acre. Well, everybody can do the math on that. It's a lot cheaper for them to pick up an extra 10% by draining their property than it is to go buy an extra 10% at five times the cost. So they're going to do it. It's a fact of life. We have to live with it. We need to continue to encourage them not to and have programs that make them not want to. Fortunately, a lot of them do care for waterfowl and wildlife. But we're losing habitat. The other part of it is, and you guys have spent a lot of time talking about, you know, the effects of pressure on ducks, which I agree 100% with, but pressure north of the border. And there may not be as many hunters there, but the other ancillary fact of having drought conditions is it not only piles all the ducks into the same area, it piles all the hunters into the same area. They know where that water is and where the ducks are. And I do get a little bit concerned with what is the toll that pressure is taking on the, particularly the young, all ducks, but a lot of the young ducks are getting killed. Again, I don't know if that's a meaningful number. I don't have that data. I mean, I can look at U.S. Fish and Wildlife data, but I'm concerned that this even amplifies the harvest when the habitat is shrunken like it is today, if that makes sense.
Well, I think talking about farming practices, I got a video a couple of people sent to me over the weekend that showed a lot of what's going on up there. And if you don't understand kind of how these potholes work and how farming works, I mean, it's as simple as the operator pulling a piece of equipment substantially wider than the machine and just hangs it over into the edge of the water in the mud. And now it's broke open and it's going to dry. And like you said, in these droughts, once it is drained, it's farmed forever. And that's a significant thing. But I think it speaks to your work with the Nature Conservancy and the concept of farm the best, restore the rest. And you can't fault a farmer for trying to take advantage and be profitable with their land. Sometimes it just doesn't align with what we want to do as far as preserving and doing conservation work for ducks. But that's the world that we live in. And until we find a way to incentivize farmers to restore stuff, we're just kind of stuck in this cycle. But to talk, you know, kind of about the one hand proposed regulation and the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, I'm pretty proud of them, proud to be an Arkansan. I sent them a letter also and kind of challenged them to lead from the front, lead by example. We're the number one mallard harvest state in the states, also number one whitefront harvest state. And while we didn't quite get the restrictions that we wanted necessarily with white fronts, they did rein things in a little bit. So I'm proud of those two steps. I think it's a good step in the right direction with populations where they're at. I think leading by example it's an important role that someone is going to have to do. And we got pretty close to another proposed regulation. I think it's on the docket, but I don't think it's actually going to happen. And that was to kind of end the season a little bit earlier. Still 60-day season, And there are a lot of facets to that. A little shorter December split, which I think would play a role in habitat early in the year. I think, you know, when we used to periodically have that long 10-day split, it was never routinely year after year after year. And I think a lot of landowners have discovered since we've done this now 5-6+ years that 10-day split can really hurt you if you have flooded a lot of property and now you have no access as far as hunting. You're just kind of at the mercy of the ducks. And that's not to say that everything I flood is just so I can hunt it. We give up a lot of habitat just to have birds and provide for them. But at the same time, you're starting to see people flood less land because of the way that split falls. So I say that to kind of get into all the different reasons why I think ending that season on the last Sunday is important. Another is access. You're granting access to children who are out of school to be able to send the season out the same way they brought it in on the opening weekend. And I think that's got some value. But scientifically, and Brent, you and I had a conversation with one of the commissioners after we broke there. Scientifically, we know that late season harvest on hens and drakes is more additive than it is early. You know, a mallard hen that is shot November 20th in Arkansas is not nearly as valuable as one that is shot January 31st. We know that there is the potential to set her back as much as a month when she's harvested, or excuse me, when you harvest the drake late in the year, not even the hen. We're just talking about drake harvest there. So I think when the commissioners start looking at these things, they tend to look at public opinion. They tend to look at, you know, well, what do the data say about this? You know, is hen harvest this? Is it X? But there's not as much consideration given into that we know late season harvest is detrimental. We know it becomes more additive. It's a sliding scale. That's why the scientific community used to think that January 15th, they still think it. It's the whole Trent Lott thing that changed that. But the season should end January 15th. That was a kind of a hard, fast line for decades. And then, you know, we inched it back a little further because that's what the people want. And we keep doing the things because that's what the hunter wants. But anyway, I thought we were getting pretty close to having some self-restraint there. And like I said, we know the science says that there's a sliding scale of additive versus compensatory. So I guess my thing is when it's a toss-up, when it's one of these things that some people want, some people don't, it's not a hard, fast yes or no. Why don't we always err on the side of caution and science? I mean, we know dead hens don't lay eggs. So why keep killing them? I don't know. I said a lot there. I'm proud of the steps we took. I still think there's more room for improvement, but I'm glad you came on and expressed your thoughts and your take. And I hope that during this period of public comment, more people would hear your message and maybe comment and weigh in. Hopefully that they feel the same way.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree with everything you just said. I mean, again, it gets down to, we have to look at where we are today and try to be proactive and affect, you know, whatever change on whatever variables we can affect. And there's not a lot. I can't do anything about rainfall on the prairies. I can't do anything about, you know, creating breeding habitat up there. I mean, I can, I guess, by contributing to conservation organizations. But my point is that those are a long ways away from what I can really have an impact on. What I can be is selective with what I shoot. And I think there's a generation now, and again, I want to be very careful. This isn't a public versus private. This isn't an old versus young. This isn't a rich versus poor. This is just caring for ducks. And you guys, again, have said this. There's an entire generation that knows nothing more than 6 ducks, 2 hens, and 60-day season. And I think there's a real opportunity for everybody that's in this arena, the conservation organizations, the game and fish, to educate us on why we should lay off the hens at this time. And, you know, there was a time when nobody in Arkansas would shoot a doe deer. I mean, that was the sacred cow. Don't shoot the doe. She's our producer. Well, we're not quite there with ducks, but we're headed that way in a hurry. And I look at it and say, let's don't shoot the hens. They're the one, they're our factory. You know, they make baby ducks. Let's just give them a break. And, you know, you would hope people would do it voluntarily. And I think there are quite a few that do. But I think there's quite a few that may really just not understand what it's doing when they do. And so I just think there's a real chance. And really, through this regulation, a lot of people, like it or not, will become more educated. But I do think, you know, the Game and Fish, you know, has a real opportunity to, you know, to say, not only, you know, here's what we're doing, but this is why we're doing it. And this is why we should do it. And hopefully they'll follow through on that. You know, we'll see.
Yeah. And I like it. I do like it. You know, tying back to Kaysen's point. And I said this in the meeting when I was at the podium that duck hunters are looking for the commission to do something, whatever that something is. They're looking for them to do something that starts to get this train back on the tracks, because, you know, we've got a lot of dissatisfied waterfowlers for whatever reason, but a lot of it has to do with the success of you know, their harvest. And that's, you know, we all love ducks, and we like watching ducks, we like holding ducks, we like seeing them, all that stuff. But at the end of the day, when we're hunters, we like to have success afield. And, you know, whether this turns out to be that thing that kind of kickstarts some attention to, yeah, we like our 60 days. I mean, I kind of dance around that point, but what I'm trying to say is we only bring these things up because we all want to continue it to be 60 days. The three of us dealt with some 30 day seasons and some 45s and some, you know, it was all over the place back in the day. And this 60 day season sure is nice, because you have time to weather through 70 degree days and 4 degree days when everything's frozen, and cloudy days and full moon days and all that. And all this we talk about isn't really to, you know, cry and complain that, you know, duck hunting's not any good anymore. It's more in an effort to, let's not dig such a big hole it's going to take forever to climb out of, and we can figure out a way to keep a 60 day season intact. And I hope this is I hope your friend from Mississippi or your contact from Mississippi is able to maybe do the same thing over there. You know, I think Missouri probably, I believe Missouri is the next highest harvest rate in the, definitely in the lower part of the Mississippi Flyway. Cause I think they're around a little bit over 100,000 mallards, I think, in their last harvest report. So, you know, maybe somebody from Missouri says, let's think about this and let's do this. But I know they've got a lot of support from the hunters. And I know you're going to have some that are going, well, if the U.S. Fish and Wildlife said we can kill two, why are we changing? But, you know, Texas just killed the conservation season. For those that don't know, they've decided they're not going to do the snow goose conservation season anymore. Didn't feel like it was achieving the desired effect. And the goose population, snow goose population, along with speckled bellies, is way down. So they went against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service hasn't said we need to stop the conservation season. But Texas, they did a kind of audible on their own, much like we're trying to do with the mallard hen. So, you know, maybe some states are setting some precedents for others to follow, and maybe we'll have a movement like you're talking about.
Right. Well, I obviously that would be the big win, is if we all recognized it and all thought that being a little bit more conservative at this time was the way to go, which I think, you know, most of these states, their harvest is down during this period. You guys could correct me, but I'm not sure that any state's mallard harvest is going up at the moment.
No.
And so, you know, I just feel like it again is a chance to soften the, you know, the trough a little bit, or to shallow the trough a little bit. And that's what we're trying to avoid is a drastic change. I mean, it you know, I don't want a 30-day season. And I don't want a two-duck limit again. And so why not react first? Don't wait. Or why not be proactive and not reactive and wait until that time comes? And the hunters have always driven conservation. You know, every conservation organization out there was started by hunters. And so I think it's not unusual for us to be the first ones to be basically raising attention when we see things that we don't think are normal, or we don't want to be normal. So this is nothing that hadn't been done before, and I think that's just part of the role is to try to facilitate a change. So that, and then guys, if I could, I would like to say one more thing just on the importance, I think, of the predator management, which dovetails into protecting the hen. Again, we are losing habitat, but most of the hens are killed by predators. And I'm a champion for Delta waterfowl. I've supported them for a long time. I've supported this effort. And what makes so much sense to me on the predator management work that they're doing is, and again, if you think about this, is it's portable. You can take the predator management show wherever the habitat is best and get the biggest bang for the buck. You can spend a lot of money reclaiming waterfowl breeding habitat up on the prairies. But if we go through a drought like we're going right now, and that singular wetland is dry, it's not producing one duck. And so you have a pretty hefty investment in that, and you're not getting a return for your money. And again, this is by no way am disparaging habitat efforts. We need to do it. But I happen to think that the predator management is the most novel and effective technique that waterfowl has had available to it in the last 30 years when we started at Delta. And so I think it takes both. I think we need to work hard towards conserving all the habitat we can, but we need to maintain that habitat on an annual basis where we know it will produce ducks, where they do have moisture and water, and apply that funding and really focus that funding in those areas and get the biggest bang for our buck. That's what Delta's going to do. So I'm a real champion of that, and just think that it is the missing piece of the puzzle that we have needed for decades. And I hate to say that I think habitat will continue to decline, but I think it will in the long term. And so we have to figure out how to produce more ducks on less habitat. And I think that's a great way to do it. So I feel so strongly about that. I just want to make sure that I made my case on that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what's so fascinating, but also important about this and the dynamic of a duck and a mallard duck. It's all these things. It's not just, oh, we need cold weather. It's not just, oh, we need better habitat. Oh, it's not just, we need less predators. It's all of these things that all have to happen for us to get back to that kind of, you know, once upon a time, I believe the North American Waterfowl Management Plan goal was 10 million mallards. And that's, they adjust that. They were adjusting that over time. I think the last I hear lately, it was 8.5 million. But regardless, you know, we're at six now. So to get back to that, it's not going to be just because we took one hen out of the limit. You know, it's all of these things and all of these organizations and all these agency decisions, hunter decisions, exactly like you were saying, on what you pull the trigger on and what you don't. That's what's going to make us get back. It's not one thing. There's just not one silver bullet. And that's where we as a hunting community have to square off with. And a lot of people like to take stances especially on social media, that all we need is this, fill in the blank, whatever their belief is. And the more we all understand, it's all of these things. And when they do line up again, maybe we have a season like 99, 2000. Maybe we had, you know, or some of these other ones where we had three quarter. I mean, we may never get back to killing a million mallards again. We may get back to harvesting 750,000, which we've done since, you know, the invention of the spinning wing decoy and the perfect scenario on the prairies that we had there at the turn of the century. But it's just going to take a lot of things. And you've obviously been involved with several of them because you track back through your history with originally very strong advocate for Ducks Unlimited. Not that you're not now. Nature Conservancy work, national board member of Delta Waterfowl. I mean, you've got a lot of track record of understanding this big picture. And the more people we can get to understand that, I think the better off we as a hunting community will be, which in turn be better for waterfowl.
Yeah, the common thread through everything I've done is ducks. And, you know, that's always what interests me. And what are the efforts going on? And as I said, I want to hunt ducks as much as anybody else. I've spent plenty of time chasing ducks in Biomeda. I've spent plenty of time chasing ducks on the Cache and White Rivers, the different WMAs. I have done all that. I'm a little older now. I don't have quite the energy to get up as early in the morning as it takes. But I have done it all, and I have loved it all, and I have great memories from all of it. And just my voice is, you know, trying to preserve all of that. And, you know, let's do what's best for ducks when the ducks need it. Let's don't just keep pounding on them when they're down, you know. And again, let's take small steps. Collectively, all the small steps together can add up and make a difference. And that's just what I hope we can do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we say it all the time. That's part of the reason we did this podcast. It's part of the reason we have kind of guests that we have on, because we have that same passion and that same desire to see this thing perpetuate. And just think the route to that is what's best for the duck, what's best for the resource, what's best for the habitat. That's how we're going to get there.
My father's 87 years old. He still duck hunts.
Yeah.
I hope that I live to be 87, and I hope that I'm still pulling the trigger. So it's something I really want to do this for a lot more years, and I want to see plenty of ducks, which would just thrill me if we can do that.
Yeah, no question. No question. Well, David, man, we appreciate you coming on. We thought it was timely. I'm not sure everybody has picked up that the one hen thing is out there. I've seen some commentary. I've had some friends contact me, and I've brought it up to others, and they had no idea what I was talking about. So it'll gather a little more steam as they get closer to that May commission meeting and actually vote to put in, you know, the rules and regs for this next season. But we thought it was timely to get you on. And since you got in front of the commission and kind of championed this concept, that people could hear your story that obviously weren't in the meeting and didn't get to hear that, and make sense of why this has such a potential multiplying impact for waterfowl.
Right. Well, great. Well, thank you for having me. You could have had a lot of people instead of me, but I am passionate about it. I believe what I believe. And thank you for giving me a platform just to share that.
You bet. You bet. Well, that's another episode of The Standard Sportsman. You know where to catch us online, at The Standard Sportsman. And well, that's the social media. And then the website's www.thestandardsportsman.com. We'll be back next week with another episode. Be sure to tell your friends about the show, and we will catch you next time. Thanks.
Light boots, the lightest pair of knee boots you're ever going to find. Weighing in at just 13 ounces each. Putting on a pair of light boots is truly a jaw-dropping experience.